Well, welcome back once again to the Men We Need podcast. I've got a real treat for you this week. We've been talking off air and having a few laughs about some of the Boys Ed suspects that we know. Today, I've got the privilege of talking with Dr. Abigail Northfleet James, who's joining us from Virginia. And we're in deep winter here, but I was just noticing the light shining through the window where Abigail's sitting. And you're heading, what, into midsummer now?
We are about 32 degrees this afternoon.
32 degrees. That's Celsius, correct?
Celsius, yes.
Wow. Virginia, does Virginia have beaches?
Yes, it does. Virginia Beach.
Okay. Someone told me that the other day, actually. Okay.
Very lovely beach.
Well, listen, a little bit of background on you first. I'm really going to put a whole bunch of stuff linking back to your site underneath the interview here, but you know, Dr. James has done some amazing work in boys' ed around the world, and a real focus on gender-based learning, both you know, very much for boys, but also for girls. She's the author of four fantastic books. The latest one just came out December last year. So we have Teaching the Male Brain, How Boys Think, Feel, and Learn in School, and her latest book, The Parent's Guide to Boys, Help Your Son Get the Most Out of School and Life. So we're going to send that to our parent list too, if you're a parent listening to this. But just before we get stuck in, the other interesting thing that you discover when you have a look around Dr. James's website is that she grew up actually at an all-boys school with her father working there, and then attended.
And my mother.
And your mother working there.
And my mother taught there too.
Wow. Well, it's funny how you end up talking to people, because Karen and I, when we were first married, same thing. We ended up as a young couple in a boarding school, and then you began there, and then you ended up being educated at an all-girls school. So you saw both sides of the perspective. So tell us a little bit more about the journey. Why has your life brought you to this particular kind of work?
Well, when I graduated with a degree in science ed, I went to teach in a girls' school. I was a girl, after all, and I had gone to a girls' school.
Makes sense.
And so I worked. That was St. Agnes.
Okay.
Near in the suburbs of Washington, D.C.
Yep.
Then my husband took me to a boys' school, Blue Ridge School, which is in the mountains of Virginia. Yep. And we were there for 3 years, and I taught science. I was a house parent. And then we decided to start our own business. And so there are a couple holes in my vita. This is one of them. We had our own business for a while. And then I was invited to be the head of the science department at a different girls' school, Stuart Hall.
Yep.
And I left there because I had another opportunity to do something outside of school. And then I had a son. So not only am I a teacher of boys, but I'm also the mother of a boy who wasn't a great student.
Okay.
And then the school where I had grown up invited me to teach science. And I taught there for 12 years.
Wow.
Taught science and advanced placement psychology and a little bit of math every now and then. So when my son went off to boarding school, I decided that I needed to be a little busier than I was. So I went back to graduate school to study the education of boys at the University of Virginia. And I did some research on the attitudes of boys who were graduates of single-sex schools as compared to the similar boys who had gone to similar co-ed schools.
Yep.
And when I graduated, I had every intention of going back to teaching at the boys' school, every intention. But of course, in 4 years, they'd fill my place. So I took a part-time position first of all, I did a postdoctoral fellowship in neuroscience. And when I did that, I suddenly realized there were reasons why we do what we do in boys' schools. And they're very good, solid neuroscientific reasons.
Yep.
With my background in biology, it was easy to do that.
Yeah.
So then I got a part-time job teaching at a local community college. In the States, a community college is sort of a step between high school and university.
Yeah.
And I have enjoyed doing that, and it's allowed me to go back into the classroom to teach in my local public high school. I teach for the community college, and now I teach a co-ed class.
Wow.
Of seniors, and it has convinced me that single-sex education is the way to go.
Yeah,
it's very hard for me to teach that class. But in the meantime, I've written a few books, as you mentioned, on teaching boys and teaching girls. And then the latest one came about because I work with boys' schools around the world. And when I go, I frequently speak to parents. And parents have said, you know, don't you have a book like Teaching the Male Brain for Parents? And I said, no, but I guess I could make one. And so that's where The Parent's Guide to Boys is. And it's basically a book from a teacher of boys who also happens to be the mother of a boy on things that your teacher wishes your son could do.
So tell us, at the end of the day, you know, you've done so much work here. What's the source of the interest? What do you find so compelling about either boys' education or, you know, the particular, you know, importance of gender-based education?
Well, I have the brain of a 14-year-old boy with better verbal skills. I learn exactly the way a boy learns. Yep. If you tell me something, I forget it.
Yep.
If you let me do it, see it, make charts, graphs, tables, I've got it and I don't have to redo it. But just to read a book, and I read very well. I have very good verbal skills, but I don't really remember what I read, and I certainly don't remember a lot of what I'm told.
So what's the core neurological basis of this? Like in a previous podcast, we've talked about, you know, the corpus callosum joining the hemispheres and you know, the obliteration of gender difference is kind of a cultural project at the moment, but you would you'd argue that there is fundamental neurological difference here. So can you give us a sort of a layperson's insight into that neurological difference?
Well, there are basically four neurological differences that are developmental, that pretty much everybody agrees on, even the people who do not agree that single-sex education is the way to go. One of them is that male brains are bigger than female brains. Even though males are bigger than females, the male brain is about 10% larger. We don't know what advantage it gives men, but we assume at some point we'll figure out why that's true.
Yeah.
Number two, as of the day children are born, the left side of the brain is developing slightly faster in girls and the right side slightly faster in boys. What that means is that because the left side of the brain is where the verbal center begins, that gives girls a slight verbal advantage. As a matter of fact, a 20-month-old girl has about twice the active vocabulary of a 20-month-old boy.
Wow.
Now, when I say average, I'm not talking about individual children. Certainly, there are 20-month-old boys who are chatty as they can be and 20-month-old girls who are silent.
Mm-hmm.
But teachers don't deal with – we don't deal with specific children. We deal with average children.
Yeah.
And so – what happens is when children enter school, the girls have a verbal advantage and the boys who are very competitive, and there is some concern that that is learned. There's some concern that that's an innate thing. But in any case, whatever the cause, boys are competitive. And when they can't compete, they give up.
Yeah.
And they back off and they go off and throw things.
Yep.
And why do they throw things? Because the right side of their brain is developing slightly better. It's faster. And that's where spatial skills begin. And that's why a 20-month-old boy can throw a ball better than a 20-month-old girl.
Yep.
Now, we spend a huge amount of time in school making up for those verbal disadvantage of boys.
Yeah.
We spend practically no time making up for the spatial disadvantage for girls.
Wow.
And what the consequence is, we have women who claim they can't do math, but research is very clear that girls can do math, but they do need spatial skills.
Wow.
Okay, so that's two of them.
Yep.
The third one is that as of the day children are born, the amygdala and the hippocampus are two little tiny bits of tissue in your brain that if you drew lines through your eyes and through your ears, where those lines intersect, the base of your brain, you'd find these. The hippocampus is developing slightly faster in girls. The hippocampus is the source of our abilities to turn short-term memory into long-term memory.
Yep.
Does that mean that little girls have better memories than little boys? We don't know, because all the tests use words. Mm. But there's some theory that there is a slight advantage that girls have, at least early in school, for memory. Boys, on the other hand, the amygdala is developing slightly faster in boys. The amygdala is what gets excited when we deal with strong emotions.
Emotions, yeah.
Either ours or dealing with somebody else's strong emotions.
Yep.
Many people are shocked when I say to them, I tell you that boys are at least as emotional as girls, and I think that little boys are more emotional than girls.
Yeah.
And women say to me, oh, men are not emotional. I said, no. Men are more emotional. They just don't have the language to tell you.
Yeah.
Because boys want to show you what they're excited about. Girls want to tell you.
Yeah.
And there's a huge difference. School isn't interested in showing you. So we have to spend a lot of time helping boys get those verbal skills. And in a single-sex school, it's easier because the fact that the boy is not as good as the girl sitting next to him isn't a big deal because it's just boys. The last difference is that the prefrontal lobe, the part of your brain that's right behind your eyebrows, that part of the brain is the last to develop. It is the location of what we call the executive decision maker. Yep. It's what allows us to make reasoned decisions and to control our impulses. Girls finally begins to come online, coalesce about ages 18 to 20. As a teacher of teenage girls, I can tell you at a 15 or 16-year-old girl, I can generally see that she's beginning to make those long-term plans. With boys, that part of the brain does not come online until 20 to 25. And one of the researchers who looks at this says he's got some men in his study who are 30. These prefrontal lobes have not quite finished.
Correct.
So what that means is that boys tend to be late in school. They're still impulsive. They're still unable to make long-term decisions. Their planning is a little rough, that sort of thing. There's a group of people in the United States who are opposed to single-sex education, and they agree that that part of the brain does develop later. And they say, but of course, it has no effect on education. All that tells me is those people have never taught.
Yeah.
Because every school teacher knows, oh, yeah, it does. Lots of it. So those are the four basic differences. One, of course, the larger brain size doesn't seem to have any difference. But the other three make a huge difference in the way the world experiences a child and the way a child experiences the world.
Yeah.
And that's got to make a difference in what happens to him in the classroom. Then you combine that with the fact that the person standing at the front of the classroom is almost entirely female.
Yeah.
90 to 95% of people who teach in primary schools around the world are women.
Yeah.
And they look at the impulsive, loud, physically active boy as a problem. And I constantly am saying, you know, he doesn't do this on purpose. This is just the way he behaves.
Yeah.
So, well, he could behave if he wanted to. I went, yeah, for a short period of time. But they spend a huge amount of time telling him to be quiet, sit down, put a lid on it, rather than teaching them how to manage themselves, which would be so much more helpful.
Yeah. Look, you have raised so many things, just alarm bells went off all over the place. One of the things you mentioned was, you know, when boys discover that they can't compete, and, you know, you talked about whether this competitive drive is innate or socialized. One of the points we make in our programs is that, you know, boys withdraw pretty soon if they can't play the game.
Absolutely.
And they withdraw into this kind of passivity or aggression, you know, the passive aggressive response. So I've got a whole bunch of questions for you here, but let's just start with that one. How do we stop them withdrawing? Or if they do, how can we bring them back?
I have to tell you, I have been working with a woman on my blog all day today,
yep,
whose son, who's 11, has simply become totally passive. He won't do anything.
Yep.
And I'm trying to explain to this woman that he's overwhelmed by life. He's 11. And somewhere along the line, he simply couldn't compete. And it's just easier to back off and say, tell me what to do. Just plan my life for me. And the problem with that is that it becomes a habit, and the habit of a lifetime. And you get young men who at 15 and 16 are playing video games in their parents' basement.
Yeah.
They're not doing anything because nobody made them do it.
Yeah.
And I go into a boys' school and I rarely see that behavior. Rarely.
Yeah.
Because competing with buddies, mates, is totally different than trying to compete with a girl because it's not fair. She's got all the skills that he doesn't have and he's not going to have.
Yeah.
Now, if he's got a wise teacher who's going to say, look, tell you what, you do it this way, she's going to do it that way, you get to do it this way. Everybody in the class benefits. I, myself, with my 14-year-old boy brain, would have benefited. I almost flunked out of high school because I was doing what those boys are doing. You know, I'm not, you know, tell me what to do. And if you don't tell me what to do, then I'm not doing anything.
Yeah.
And it's trying to motivate boys is so, it's so easy if you know what you're doing and so hard if you don't.
Yeah.
But a lot of it has to do with I was just reading some research yesterday, as a matter of fact, on the way that males deal with competition. And I've not finished really sort of digesting that article yet, so I'm not willing to sort of go out on a limb. But suffice it to say that what this article is aimed for is telling me that what works for boys is they need to be with a group of boys, and they have to be near the thing they're competing with. It can't be at a distance.
Yeah.
So it can't be theoretical. It's got to be real. It's got to be right there. When you see boys out in the grounds with things in their hands, they will compete with girls that way.
Yeah.
When there are things that are proximal, near to them. But when you say sit in your chair, and now the work is at a distance because it's at the teacher at the front of the room, now he's not competitive.
Hmm.
He competes in sport because it's next to him physically. He's not competing in school because it's too far away from him.
Yeah.
And we need to get boys right there, right engaged in what they're doing, and that will get them to compete.
So it's a question of immediacy, isn't it? I mean, to summarize what you're saying there, if someone's saying to them, you know, work hard now in grade 9 so you get into university, they're like, it's abstract. Yeah.
Abstract. No. I would never say that to a year 9 boy. I would say to a year 9 boy, work right now so that you'll figure out how to solve this problem right now.
I remember
he's not interested in what's going to happen in
years ago.
Years.
I remember when I was teaching, I got published in a journal at the Boys Ed Center at Newcastle University. I just got my entire class into particular teams, and over a term, we scored everything from homework completed to, you know, stuff in the classroom. Everything was competitive. Everything was, you know, and the winning team, and I don't remember how we funded this. We may have mugged some old people, but we took them go-karting to motorized go-karts, the winning team, you know, and just, you know, and what they do is they self-regulate and they group regulate. So if somebody's not pulling the weight in the team gets around them and says, hang on, you know, and it was just, and I think if I remember, we also had some compensation prizes so that there were no, you know, so that the follow-ups, you know, the runners-up also had some sense of success. But look, the other one I want to talk to you about was we talked a bit about emotions, and I remember when I was speaking with parents saying that some research, and I wouldn't have this right in front of me, you know, boys will tend to collapse down into 4 or 5 main emotions. And I used to say, well, I actually, you know, some people say it's 2. Boys do anger and fear. Whereas, and the funny thing was, I was on stage, I had 400 parents, and I said, you know, boys tend to collapse to these 2 dominant emotions, whereas, you know, women have this nuance. They can name all these emotions, such as, and I tried to name a bunch of emotions live on stage, and I couldn't do it. And they're all just, everybody just was laughing hysterically. I was like, wow. And, so let's talk a little bit about that emotionality now. I've got a 4-year-old son, and it's interesting times. He's a very gentle, beautiful little boy, and this corpus callosum thing, this inability to articulate verbally what they're feeling at that emotional level. So, talk to me about the emotions of boys. Are we killing them off in terms of socialization? Are we still in the era of boys don't cry? What's happening emotionally for boys?
I truly worry about that. And it comes because females mediate their emotions verbally. And so when I go into a co-ed classroom, or sometimes when I go into a boys' school with a female at the head who's not been there for a long time, you'll see a boy getting very upset, and she'll say, "Now use your words." I'm like, "I'm really sorry, lady. He doesn't have any words to use." what I want him to do is I want him to draw a picture.
Yeah.
I might get him to take little beanbags and throw them against the wall until he can manage himself a little better.
Yeah.
I frequently tell my grade 9 boys, go out and run around the building 3 times until you're breathing hard and then come back in.
Yeah.
Because they don't have the words. And that's one of the things that school needs to do. And I'm always saying to boys' schools, that's what you all do best, is you give boys an emotional vocabulary.
Wow.
There's some research from the UK that said that kindergarten and grade one boys got into more trouble in school than girls did. Not because they were doing more things. No, in fact, they weren't. The girls were just as bad as the little boys. But the difference was that when the girls were caught by the teacher, they could come back and say, oh, it really wasn't me. She made me do it. They had ways to intercede for themselves.
Wow.
And the little boys just kind of stood there when asked if they'd done this and didn't say anything.
Yeah.
So the teacher assumed they were guilty.
Hmm.
And it was this business of giving a boy vocabulary to defend himself,
yeah.
And all of a sudden, school's not so bad. One of the things I'm constantly telling teachers is, you have no idea, when you ask a question of children, count how many seconds you wait before you expect an answer.
Yeah.
I think you'll find it's really short.
Yeah.
And boys need a little more time, which is one of the reasons I'm always saying, what you want to do is you want to make children probably from maybe grade 4 up. When I ask a child a question in class, I ask them to stand up. I'll say, Mr. Smith, Miss Jones, stand up. First of all, it alerts the kid that they're being asked a question. And second of all, gives them a little time to sort of orient to the
yep.
fact that there are words coming at them.
Yep.
But when we're talking about emotions, a lot of schools these days seem to be afraid of dealing with emotions.
Yeah.
We want everybody to be pleasant. We want everything to be nice. And in fact, the world isn't that way.
No.
We need to be a little more honest about our emotions. But the girls are able to talk about them. I'm upset with you. I'm mad. She doesn't, you know, she said something bad to me, that kind of thing. And the boy just threw something.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't have the language. And we've got to get across to people
yeah.
that it's not that the boy is more emotional, that he's having a bigger time. And we need to give him that emotional vocabulary. We also, and one of the ways to do it is he needs to see men modeling that.
Yeah.
And that's another problem is we don't have very many men in primary schools.
Yep.
As I always say, the only place you're going to find a man in a primary school is in the front office, on the sport field, or in the janitor's closet.
Yeah.
You don't see them in the classroom. And so, we need
– So on, yeah. on that, I mean, this is a very broad question, but, you know, I think it was David Blankenhorn's famous book, Fatherless America – What are your insights into this? I mean, even here in Australia, and this isn't passing value judgments on people's relationship breakdowns, but it's, you know, the absence of men in the lives of boys is enormous.
So bad.
Two things. What do you see as the impact? And secondly, anything we can do, anything other men can do stepping in?
Well, the place that I see this most vividly is the inner city schools that I work with, particularly for boys of color. Those boys, and also the schools of the very, very wealthy.
Yep.
Both of those, strangely enough, are places where these boys don't have fathers in the home. The boys of color, because the fathers are unemployed, may not even be present in the family life.
Yep.
And in the very wealthy, it's because dad's always gone making money and he's not home very often.
Yep.
And these are the children who are the most in trouble, the ones who are for whom education means the least.
Yep.
Because they don't see men in school.
Yeah.
Now, when I go to one of these schools that's designed for the boys of color in the inner city, and I see men all over the place, the whole attitude of these little boys is so much better.
Yeah.
They see that school is a place for men. They don't have a model for what it looks like
yeah.
to be a man reading a book,
yeah.
for example. So one of the things that I'm always saying to schools who say, well, we got a problem. There are no men out there to hire to be school teachers. And I say, fine. There are other ways to get men in your school.
Yeah.
Remember that Dennis the Menace spends more time with his elderly next door neighbor
yeah.
Than he does with his father.
Correct.
So get some granddads in.
Yeah.
Uncles. You can also use a lot of big businesses will lend their executives out.
Wow.
To do community service.
Yeah.
You get these guys in a three-piece suit coming in to read to the kindergarten
wow.
class. It works. Better that they should see it that way. You've also got older boys, scouts, boys in single-sex schools who have to do community service. get them to come in and work with the little boys.
Just on that, I remember the University of Newcastle years ago, who do a lot of boys' ed stuff, was saying that one of the problems for men is that schools for men quite scary, confronting places because men like certainty, control. You know, they used to say that, you know, Steve Bidoff used to say when men walk into a room, they want to know three things: who's in charge, what are the rules, will the rules be enforced? And I often say when I'm talking to teachers or parents, I go, look, you know, the problem is we say get dads in, but if you put a letter out there saying come in and, you know, fathers are like, this is an alien environment for me. I don't know who's in charge. And I say to audiences, what you have to do is you've got to trick men. So in Australia, what we do is we say, look, we don't want you to come in and do much. We're going to cook a barbecue for a parent breakfast and we just need the men to help out there. And you got to ease them in because men go, oh, okay, well, then I'm not having to do anything really, you know, where I can fail. I'm just coming in to do this. So I love what you're saying about getting men in there. It's really important.
Well, one of the things that it really helps is to have a granddad's day at school where boys bring their dad, the granddads, all the children bring their granddads or grandparents in.
Yep.
And you're very much more likely to get a granddad in than you are a dad because the granddad doesn't have quite so much to prove.
Sure.
So once you get a few in, then you can say, hey, sir, you came. Would you mind coming next week and reading to a group of boys?
Wow.
They really need, you know, pick your book. I'll help you.
Hmm.
And here's the place, you know, structure it so that all you got to do is come in, spend 20 minutes reading, you know, some children's book to these little kids.
Yeah.
And it won't be long before, and you're not going to get a lot of them, but it doesn't take a lot.
Yeah.
You just need a couple of guys who are coming in regularly.
Well,
I was in a school not long ago, and I was observing what was going on in the classroom, and this older gentleman walked in, sat down, and started working with this kid in the corner. And I said to the teacher, I haven't seen him before. Is he a teacher? And she said, no, he's just a volunteer. His kids have already graduated from here,
yeah,
but he likes to come in and work with the kids.
Wow.
Cool.
Well, it's like listening to you, it doesn't matter whether a boy is 6 or a man 60. They just need a little bit of success, don't they? Just
a
small win and a small sense of, you know, competence and mastery, and they can
go
from there.
One of the things that helps with getting these guys in to help is you've got to find the right woman to ask.
Right.
Because many women overwhelm with words.
Okay.
They say, oh, this is what you're going to do, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and this is and he's already overwhelmed.
Yeah.
What he wants is somebody to come and say, hey, do you mind coming in and reading for an hour or reading for 20 minutes? I got a place for you to be. You got a book you'd like?
Yeah.
That's really all he needs.
Yeah.
Don't want to overwhelm him with too many words. Don't be too nice about it.
So
you need to find a woman who's got a man's brain.
Who's got a man's brain. As we were talking before about the absence of men, I've often wondered, you know, if we join two dots here, is I wonder if in boys, in the absence of fathers and men, there's a kind of existential grief that they can't articulate and then channels out into rage and anger.
I see it a lot in a boarding school with, I can almost tell you which boys have the most absent fathers.
Yeah.
They're the ones who push the most people away, and they're also the ones who, when they finally realize that the men in this school are there, they are always going to be there, they're the ones who adopt the school as home.
Yeah, gotcha.
Because they really, really need it. And I've seen that happen in boys who are 18 years old who come to us for a year. And they spend half the year pushing us away and saying, you know, I don't want to have anything to do with you guys. I'm just here for 1 year. And then all of a sudden they realize that these men are there. They are there for them. They will always be there for them. They can be trusted.
Yeah.
That's one of the problems is it's really hard to trust when nobody's been trustworthy.
Yeah. In the men's work I do, we talk about this core need for affirmation that the boy, I mean, in previous podcasts, we talk a great deal about initiation and all that stuff that's missing.
Yes.
But there must be, I mentioned kind of an existential grief, but there must be wounds of rejection too, is, you know, they don't have the verbal linguistic capacity to, and you know, the prefrontal cortex isn't done till 25. So they're not there.
Right.
They're not there at 10, able to go, I'm experiencing deep wounds of rejection from my father, and they can't process that. So it must.
They really can't.
Well, so look, tell me, someone listening to this in a command and control style school, you know, must be listening there. You know, what do you say to the people that are like, well, this is all very nice, it's all very interesting, but we live with the reality and we have to have, you know, classrooms that function. How do you talk initially to those command and control types that are just used to the way things are?
I really don't have any problem with command and control. If you come into some of my science classrooms, you're going to find me in the front being very directive.
Yeah.
But in fact, that particular kind of approach doesn't work very well in getting information across to either boys or girls.
Yeah.
The girls will smile and say, yes, ma'am, and no, sir, and I get it, but they really don't, and you don't find it until much later. The boys, the advantage with boys is they'll tell you right up front that you're not getting across to them.
Yeah.
That teaching is really an interactive event. And I always say the first thing you do when you face a group of kids is ask them what they know. Don't tell them what they need to know.
Hmm.
You need to ask them so that you can, because you'd be surprised. You may not have to teach as much as you think you do.
Yeah.
And you can move on. But the command and control, I work with military schools in the United States, and they're very much that way. And for certain group of boys, they're extremely effective.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is exactly what these boys need. They need the trust that comes from people saying, this is what you got to do, and you're doing it every day. Absolutely.
And predictability, isn't it? Predictability.
Yeah. That predictability, because they come from such a chaotic background.
Yeah.
I don't think it's useful for most kids. And it's not useful for most kids. It never was. People say, oh, well, you're new and you're modern teaching. Let's get it straight. I'm 65 years old. Mm. I am not a new person. I've been teaching this way for 40 years.
Yeah.
And I have long known, my parents taught this way.
Yeah.
I mean, my father would start his French class every year, his first year French class, and say, what French words do you know?
Yeah.
And it was surprising. You know, they knew a few.
Yeah.
And that it gives them a chance to be a part of it, to start developing those give and take. It doesn't mean that your class is going to devolve into chaos.
Yeah.
And the command and control types, some of them seem to think that if you're not in total control, your room is in chaos. And my point is, no. If you've got children who are engaged in the learning process, that is what you want.
Yeah.
If children are not engaged in the learning process, then you have chaos in your classroom, whether it looks like it or not.
Well, it's interesting, is it? The Latin etymology of education from educare, meaning to draw forth, was already there. Right. And listening to you, it's like it's a sense of education is something you do with young people. You don't do it to them.
Well, as a science teacher, one of the things I'm always saying to people is if your way of teaching science is to stand up and give them facts, you're not teaching science, you're teaching history, because you're telling them what happened.
Yep.
Science is an active, living thing. It is what is happening in the world. So children have to be engaged in it. My classes are almost entirely lab-based because we're constantly doing stuff. And the teachers say to me, how can you do that? When are you ever going to get the facts across? And I said, by doing the labs. That's when they're getting the facts.
Yeah.
They're learning through this process. Yeah. And it works really well.
Yeah, you got to sneak up on them.
Sneak up on them. And there are ways, and I've developed ways to do this in every class there is.
Yeah.
There are ways to make the learning process an interactive event, because when that happens, then you get children whose faces tell you they want to be there. They're engaged. They're part of the process.
Okay.
And when they're part of the process, basically a lot of this other stuff disappears.
So a couple of quick ones for you. One is my father-in-law does amazing work counseling men with drug and alcohol problems, and he talks about one of the mantras they have is unrelenting positive regard, is that no matter what this person tells you, no matter what their background is, no matter what they've done, the general disposition of the counselor is unrelenting positive regard. So listening to you, you know, it must be part of your passion and where your energy comes from is that you just see possibility and inherent goodness in boys and young people in general.
It was really funny. Years ago, when I was teaching at the boys' school where I grew up, we had a young man who came to work for us for 2 years. He was paying back his school loans before he went to medical school. And he was terrible. He was an awful teacher. I think he was. He became a pretty good doctor, but he was a terrible teacher. And the head of our department, who is probably one of the most gifted teachers I've ever run into, I heard him walking down the hall with this fellow one day, and he was trying to get across to him some of the things that he needed to work on. And the kid finally turns around and says to Jim Reed, who's this fellow, this great teacher, and he says, look, he said, I'm not positive like you and Abigail are. You two seem to find the best in every kid. He said, I only see the worst. And Jim and I talked later, and I said, nope, he's never going to make it as a teacher. Teachers have to believe that tomorrow the worst kid in your class is going to magically become the best kid, because children's development changes that rapidly. And if you don't give them the impression that you believe that to be true, there's something called self-fulfilling prophecy. Guess what? They will not change.
So here's a tough one then. This is, do you think great teachers are born or made?
Both.
Take option C.
People will always tell you that I have a friend of mine who's a great education teacher, and she says, I'm an intuitive teacher. I don't really think about what I'm doing. I just do it. And I said, yeah, and neither of my parents were trained teachers, but they were both very good teachers. Both of them had other jobs before they came to teaching, and they're just great explainers. And I grew up in a household of explainers. But I have seen, I had an intern one time in summer school who came at the beginning of the school year, and she was just awful. Just awful. But wanted to do it. And over several years of working with me and doing her internships in other schools, she's developed into a really good teacher. She really has. But it takes – I don't know how long she's going to be able to do it. I don't think about what I do. I just walk into a classroom and it happens. It's not quite true, but it's a lot true. She has to think about almost everything she does. So I think there are just some of us who just – it comes to us naturally, whether we're taught or not. And, yeah, I do use all those things that I was taught when I got my degrees in education. But some of them I do, and I don't think about it.
I remember saying when I did a 4-year teaching degree, and I mean this with no arrogance, I may have learned one or two things vaguely, but I think I probably could have walked out at the end of day one into a classroom and probably nailed it, you know, without, and I don't mean that with any arrogance, it was just some of the teaching courses. It was just there. And
I had a teacher in one of my graduate education classes that I was teaching on the problems of boys in school. And this is a fellow who has won national awards for being a teacher in the States. He was in my class simply because he had to collect another couple of hours to upgrade his teaching certificate. And when he left my class, he turned around, Ted turned to me and he said, this is the only class I've ever had in education that actually gave me some strategies I can use in the classroom. And I said, that's just because I'm a science teacher. It's not that it's that I'm a great educator. I'm a science teacher, and I'm just teaching you the science of teaching.
So last couple of questions for you. One is, how do I frame this one? You know, I've always taught boys, and I thought I would, I mean, I've delivered many seminars with co-ed, but I, you know, to teach in an all-girls school would possibly be a bridge too far for me. I grew up with four brothers. I went to all-boys school. So let's flip it the other way. Let's imagine we have a female teacher listening to this, and, you know, we all know those teachers that boys will just try and steamroll. And give me some tips for helping female educators who are listening to this. How can they really, you know, reach boys and develop really positive classrooms with boys? What do they need to know?
Well, the first thing they need to understand is that most of the behaviors that they're seeing are not directed at them personally. If they don't believe me, follow that boy through his classes and see if he's not doing similar stuff in other people's classrooms. So it's not personal, first of all. That their behavior is not to be judged as if it were a girl. So, for example, I had a student, one of my favorite students, has a habit of grinning when he's being called to task.
Yep.
And the female, one of his female teachers at the boys' school, told me that he was laughing at her.
Yeah.
And I kept saying to her, "No, he's not. That's what he does when he's nervous."
Yeah.
She said, "No, I've never known anybody to do that before." And I thought, "You've been here in a boys' school for 20 years, and you've never seen a kid grin when he's nervous?
Yeah.
It's a common problem for boys."
Absolutely.
So one of the things you need to do is, if you've got a problem with a kid, check with somebody, find out who that kid likes, and check with that teacher and find out what that teacher is doing in that class
yep.
that the kid likes better.
Yeah.
One of the other things is listen to boys. And I say this, and teachers say, "Well, they don't say anything." And I said, "Well, they don't because you talk too fast."
Yeah.
Don't sit a boy down in front of you and say, "Okay, you know, you're having trouble in my class. Look me in the face now and tell me what your problem is." That makes a boy really nervous.
Yep.
What you do is you say, "Come help me put this stuff away," and talk to him about whatever you know he's interested in. And eventually the problems will come out,
yeah.
but he can't look at you. Don't assume that because a boy is not looking at you, he is not listening.
Yep.
Boys don't. There's some evidence that men don't look well at things that are not moving.
Yep.
And when a teacher who, you know, you can see me through this video thing and you'll notice that my hands are constantly moving. I'm constantly yeah. bobbing a little bit.
Yep.
That's typical for me. So I'm a kind of a moving target. I don't stand and I don't sit still well.
Yep.
So I'm constantly providing just a little bit for a boy to look at. But even then, I assume he's not going to. And what you need to do, sometimes you may need to let a boy stand up and walk back and forth in the back of the classroom. You'd be surprised at how much he can pay attention when he's doing that.
Yeah.
If a boy constantly is manipulating something, he's doodling, he's bouncing a pencil or something, give him a squeezy toy. There's research that says that a boy who's got something to manipulate in his hand may well be paying better attention.
Wow.
I use little foam stars because they're the right shape, and yeah. I get them in all kinds of places, science museums primarily.
Yeah.
But most importantly, if you're a teacher, first of all, please know that research is really, really, really clear on the fact that it does not matter to a boy whether the teacher is male or female.
Yeah.
As long as the teacher understands him, he's going to work.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if he believes that you do not like him or do not care about him, he will not work for you.
Yeah.
Absolutely will not. So find a teacher he does work for and find out what's going on there.
Wow, there's a lot of humility in that, isn't there? The you know, the ability to go and ask for that kind of insight and help.
Yes.
So last major
for every kid.
Yeah, yeah. Well, last major question for you. I want to give you a hypothetical, and I know your brain will want more data. But I'm thinking, you go into a school, and it's a train wreck, and it's an all boys school, and they say to you, you know, Abigail, we can only afford two ideas. We want your two best ideas on how we can start to turn this school around. What would you tell them?
Oh, well, it depends on the age of the kids.
Okay, all right.
It really does.
Well, many of our listeners to this will be high school based. So it's a high school. They're swinging off the chandeliers. They're they're setting fire to things.
Yep.
What are the top two things you think you could suggest to turn a boys' school around?
The first thing you probably need to do is start getting them engaged in something outdoors.
Yep.
Which is so much easier in Australia than it is anywhere else. I'm always saying that the reason that Australia has so few kids identified with ADHD is they send them outdoors. But outdoors is a great place. And even if you're just having them outdoors and doing something physical.
Yeah.
But the second thing is I would start with a physical approach to learning.
Yeah.
So if I'm going to have math class, I'm going to have them stand at the board doing maths on the board.
Yeah, okay.
Everybody in the whole class is standing at a standing board and working on maths together because they can't see each other.
Yeah.
And the teacher can stand and look over their shoulders. So, you know, that's, you do that. I would have them stand to read. I have them, everything physical.
Yep.
I'm going to get them to, and I'm going to try to get them as, find out where they're comfortable. It's that old thing of going back until they're in the information until they're comfortable. Because if you start, I don't care that this is the information that they're supposed to be covering in this class.
Yeah.
If they're not there, they're not ready for it. You're not, I don't care what you do, you're going to get bad behavior.
So physical based learning, and number two.
All right. So number two would be develop a sense of humor.
Yeah.
Boys are hysterically funny. And if you don't get boys' humor, then go teach girls.
Yep.
Boys make me laugh every day.
Yeah.
And I do not hesitate to laugh in class.
Yeah.
I've had teachers say, oh, you can't let them know that you're laughing at them. And why not? They're funny and they know they are.
Yeah.
Hysterically yeah. funny. And if you do not develop a sense of humor to work with boys, you know, yeah, you got to do that.
You've just triggered two classics. I mean, I remember being in year 10 maths as a student myself, and we had a teacher who didn't have a lot of control, and it was his male teacher. He's an older man, and he used to grab his maths textbook, this big heavy book, and when the class started to go crazy, he would slam it down on the desk really loudly. So one day, we're all just running amok, and we'd all pass the word around, and we all simultaneously lifted our books up and slammed them at exactly the same moment he slammed them. And it was perfect. And in the same class, about a week later, it was bucketing down rain outside, and we were about two stories up, and one boy was misbehaving. And the teacher said, Ben, do you want to go outside and play? And the boy said, oh, that'd be fantastic, sir. Thank you. So he goes outside and he runs out in front of hundreds of, you know, students in the windows, bucketing down rain, and he's just doing cartwheels on this oval in the rain. And he got legend status. The teacher was completely undone. And so, yeah, you're right. The capacity for humor is wonderful. So I'll give you a supplementary question. Let's talk just to finish on co-ed environments. What can we do in a co-ed environment that, you know, honors and respects girls' rights and how they learn, but also what can we do for boys in that environment?
Well, it's actually a topic that I've been thinking about a lot, is how do you meet the needs of both boys and girls in the same classroom? And a lot of it has to do with the fact that girls, that the female teacher appeals to the verbally based learner, who are mostly girls, but not all girls, and some boys. And what you need to do is to help them understand that those verbally based learners are losing out because you are focusing on one kind of learning. Mm. So what you've got to do is give a wide variety of approaches. Mm-hmm. Yes, verbal, but also some of the hands-on, the writing. The girls will sit there and tell you, I can't do that, miss. Oh, yes, you can.
Yeah.
But the problem is that so many teachers are not comfortable with doing it that way themselves.
Yeah.
So they need to become more comfortable in doing approaching learning from a wide variety. You've got to widen up the things that you do. If all you're doing in class is having children read the book, talk about it, write about it, yeah, you're limiting what they're learning and you're limiting their experience.
Yeah. Look, I'll break my own rule. One last one for you is, imagine the perfect success story. One should imagine a boy that leaves a school where there's been a lot of best practice. Tell us a bit about that young man. What's he like?
Oh, it's so much fun to see them when they come to university,
yeah,
or they go to work. And because they're motivated, they're competent, they know what they want.
Yeah.
And I was looking at my own son the other day. He's now 28 of all things.
Wow.
And he started his own business. And it doesn't seem to have anything to do with what he studied in university. So he explained to me the other day that it really does, Mom, honest.
Okay.
And but the most important thing is that all the people who are working with him are depending on him to be the responsible one.
Hmm.
And I thought, yeah, and where did you learn that?
Yeah.
You learned that by going to a boys' school.
Yeah.
My son sang with the American Boy Choir.
Yeah.
at between 12 and 14. And there he was responsible for things. And that's what's – it gets, you get to see a young man who really gets life.
Yeah. Well – tell us how. I'm going to put a lot of links under this podcast and the transcript. We'll have a full transcript of it for people that like to read through it. I'm going to put all your website details up and the book details. How else – we'll have your website there, but how else can we find you? Are you on Twitter? Are you on social? Where do we find you there?
I'm on Facebook.
Yep.
I'm not on Twitter.
Okay.
And I'm only on Facebook because I have somebody who puts it up there, but I do answer – I do answer questions to the Facebook.
Fantastic.
So if you have questions, there's one for the boys. There's a Facebook account for the boys, the Parents Guide to Boys.
Yep.
And you can there are several streams that are in that one,
okay.
And you can check with those, or you can email me.
Okay. Well, we'll put all those details up. And finally, what's coming up for you? What events, conferences? What's in the pipeline? You don't seem like the kind of person that's thinking Florida, sitting in an easy chair.
Well, no, I've got the National Association for middle school principals coming up in the United States, and then the International Boys Schools Coalition annual meeting, which this year will be in the United States. Last year it was in Melbourne.
Yep.
So I was in your lovely country a year ago.
Yep.
But this year it will be in the States. I just was talking to somebody in Geneva.
Wow.
So I'm going to go work with a co-ed school in Geneva talking about teaching boys and girls together.
Fantastic. Well, listen, on behalf of us all, this has been great. Every time I do a podcast, you never know what's going to happen. And I just want to thank you for your passion, for your energy, for your huge commitment over many, many years to young people. And I often say when we get to heaven, there's going to be a huge HD screen. God sits you down with a bucket of popcorn the size of Texas and says, sit back and watch all the little conversations and influences that you had, and you're going to see how they played out in people's lives. So it may sound a bit funny to say this to you, but thank you so much for your work for young people.
Well, thank you so much, because you're making this available to people who otherwise wouldn't know much about it. Yeah. And you obviously have so much to offer as well.
Thank you. Thanks, Heap. So Dr. Abigail Northfleet James, thank you for talking with us at the Men We Need podcast.
Thank you very much, Jonathan Doyle.
Well, there you go, an absolutely fantastic interview there with Dr. Abigail Northfleet James. I really hope that you got a lot out of that. I hope you can read the transcript. And my personal request is, we love giving out all this content for free, but if you could share this with people, grab the link for this podcast, send it to other people in education who you think would benefit from the fantastic stuff that Dr. James just shared with us. Also, please make sure you check out the Men We Need program at men.choices, choices.com.au. You can find us on Twitter at Choices Media, once again with a Z, choices, Choices Media. You can also find us on Facebook at Choices Media too. Really hope this has been useful to you. Good luck with the important work you do in education, and we look forward to bringing you another great podcast very soon.